We talk a lot about holding individuals accountable, you know, for those really serious human rights violations. Like globally, it seems like, you know, a pretty basic principle, right? But then you come across a case like Doe v. Boratai. And well, it really shines a light on just how complicated things get. You see the clash between that idea of individual accountability and respecting a nation's sovereignty.
It does raise some pretty fundamental questions.
It makes you wonder just how universal justice can actually be when you put it into practice, especially for all of you law students out there, you know, wrestling with international law, human rights law. This isn't just, you know, some theoretical footnote. This is a real-world illustration of those practical challenges you're going to run into. I mean, whether you're thinking about international litigation or even just wrapping your head around, like, the boundaries of suing foreign officials, Doe v. Boratai has a lot to teach us.
It really does.
And that's what we're diving into today, right? We're going to unpack why the U.S. courts ended up dismissing this case. We'll untangle those legal knots. Foreign official immunity, limitations on jurisdiction, we'll make it clear, easy to understand, because this stuff, it can get pretty dense.
Oh, absolutely.
So to set the stage, Doe v. Boratai involved Nigerian plaintiffs. They filed this suit in the U.S. against, well, a number of high-ranking Nigerian officials, Boratai being one of them. And the allegations were heavy stuff. We're talking extrajudicial killings, torture, just awful. These actions, allegedly, took place during the Nigerian government's response to protests, specifically protests from the Biafran and Igbo communities. The plaintiffs argued this was straight-up suppression of dissent. So the plaintiffs came to the U.S. courts, and they were relying on some serious legal tools, mainly the Alien Tort Statute, the ATS, and the Torture Victim Protection Act, the TVPA. Now, these are powerful pieces of legislation. Under the right circumstances, they give U.S. courts the power to hear cases about violations of international law, even if those violations happened outside the U.S.
That's right.
So with these legal tools in hand, you might think they had a good shot, right? A solid case. But as we know, the U.S. courts dismissed the case.
They get.
So today, our deep dive, it's all about figuring out why. What were the roadblocks? What made the court say, nope, we can't hear this?
Well, the first thing to understand is that the case never even got to trial. Like, they never actually examined the evidence and decided whether those horrible things happened or not. It got dismissed way earlier, like right at the district court level. And then that dismissal was upheld on appeal.
Oh, wow. So why? What were the reasons?
Two big reasons. Lack of jurisdiction. Like, the court saying, we don't have the power to make these guys come answer to us, and then foreign official immunity.
Okay. So let's break those down, starting with foreign official immunity. It sounds like some kind of like get out of jail free card almost. What exactly is this and where does it come from?
It's kind of like a shield, a legal protection that you see it's deeply rooted in international law. And it goes hand in hand with this idea of comity. Basically, the idea that nations have to respect each other, you know, treat each other as equals. So, foreign official immunity, it says that officials from other countries, when they're doing the government jobs, they can't be sued in the courts of other countries. It prevents one country from butting into another country's business, you know, keeps things running smoothly between them.
I can see that. From a diplomatic standpoint, it makes sense. Like, can you imagine the mess if every country's courts could just haul officials from other countries in for anything they did back home?
It would be total chaos.
But how did the court decide whether these particular Nigerian officials, you know, in this situation were actually entitled to immunity? Like, how do they apply that idea to a real case?
Well, they follow this framework that comes from a Supreme Court case, Simitar v. Yusuf, a really important case. And there are three parts to this framework. First, you look at the person's official status. In Doe v. Boratai, there was no question. These defendants, they were high up in the Nigerian government, military, police, or official roles. Nobody disputed that.
Right, that was clear. So then what's the next step in this analysis?
Second part, you got to figure out if the things they're being sued for, in this case, those terrible killings and the torture, whether those things were part of their official duties.
So even if something is a clear human rights violation, if the government basically says, yeah, they were doing their job, that counts as an official act for this immunity thing. I mean, that seems, I don't know. It feels like there's some serious ethical issues with that.
It definitely highlights this tension. Like, how do you balance these competing interests? But the court's reasoning here is that if they allowed this lawsuit to go forward, against these officials for things they supposedly did under orders from their government,
yeah.
Well, that'd be like attacking the Nigerian government itself.
Oh, okay.
And that's what this comedy thing tries to avoid.
Right, I see. So it's all about respecting that other country's authority within its own borders.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the third part of the test. What's the jurisdictional effect? The court basically said, look, if we let this lawsuit go ahead, it would be like we're using U.S. law to judge what the Nigerian government did on its own turf. That steps on their sovereignty.
Okay, I followed the logic there, but the plaintiffs, they made a really compelling argument. They said, hold on, these acts, this torture, these killings, these are what we call just cogens violations. These are like the most fundamental, universally recognized, no excuses rules in international law. And they argue that those just cogens violations, they should trump any kind of immunity.
Yeah, that was a key part of their argument, no question.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, just cogens norms, things like banning torture and genocide, those are huge in international law. Like, no country can just ignore them.
Right.
However, U.S. courts, including in this case Doe v. Buratai, they've been consistent. They've said, look, based on how we currently understand U.S. common law, there's no exception to foreign official immunity just because something is a just cogens violation.
So even when you're talking about these truly horrific acts, things that pretty much everyone agrees are wrong, it doesn't automatically mean you can sue the officials responsible in a U.S. court. That's, I don't know, it's pretty disheartening for victims who are looking for justice.
It is. It really underlines how tough it is to find that balance.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, you have the idea that each country gets to run its own affairs. On the other, you have the need to hold people accountable for serious human rights abuses.
Right.
Now, there's another big issue in this case. On top of this whole immunity question, the court also said they didn't have personal jurisdiction over those Nigerian officials.
Right, right. So can you remind us what that means? What's jurisdiction in this context?
Sure. So for a U.S. court to have power over someone, to make them come answer to a lawsuit, that person usually needs to have some connection to the place where the court is.
Okay. Like, they live there, do business there, something like that.
Exactly. Or the things they're being sued for happened in that place.
So in Doe v. Buratai, the Nigerian officials, they were in Nigeria, their actions were in Nigeria.
Exactly. And the plaintiffs, they tried to use a specific rule, Rule 4K2, to get around that. This rule lets a federal court grab jurisdiction if the case involves a federal question, and the defendant isn't under the jurisdiction of any specific state court, but they have enough connections to the whole U.S. But the court said, no, these Nigerian officials, they don't have those minimum contacts with the U.S. What they did, even if it was wrong, it all happened over in Nigeria.
And the fact that the lawsuit was using those U.S. laws, the TVPA and ATS, that didn't automatically give the court jurisdiction over those foreign officials?
It didn't. While those laws, they do say what kind of cases a federal court can hear, like cases about breaking international law, they don't automatically mean the court can make any foreign official anywhere in the world show up and defend themselves.
Okay, so that's a separate issue.
It is. We talked about immunity earlier, and it's the same principle here. If Congress wants to overturn a long-standing legal tradition, like foreign official immunity, or if they want to give courts power over people in other countries, they have to say so directly and clearly in the law.
Right.
And neither the ATS nor the PDPA does that in this specific situation.
This case, Doe v. Buratai, it really shows the struggle. How do you balance a country's right to govern itself with the need to hold people responsible when really terrible human rights abuses are happening?
Absolutely.
And it seems like in cases like this, the U.S. courts, they tend to defer to the executive branch, you know, like the State Department when it comes to foreign policy.
You're right. Courts often give the executive branch a lot of leeway in those situations, especially when it comes to foreign relations and immunity. In Doe v. Buratai, the court mentioned that the State Department hadn't formally suggested immunity for these officials.
Mm.
But even so, the court's decision definitely shows that they're hesitant to step on the executive branch's toes when it comes to foreign policy.
Okay.
Like, generally, the executive branch gets to decide how the U.S. interacts with other countries, and courts don't want to mess that up.
That makes sense. So for all those law students listening who, you know, might be dreaming of a career in human rights law, maybe even suing foreign officials in U.S. courts, what should they learn from Doe Buratai? What are the key takeaways here, like the practical realities they need to know?
Well, first off, getting past that foreign official immunity hurdle, it's not easy. Unless you can clearly show those officials were acting like rogue agents, totally on their own, without their government's backing. Or unless Congress passes a specific law taking away immunity in that situation, it's going to be a tough fight.
Yeah.
Second takeaway, we've said it before, but it's important. Just because something is a just Kojin's violation, like the worst of the worst, that alone isn't enough to say, okay, no immunity here.
Right.
At least not how U.S. courts see it right now.
Yeah.
And finally, remember that other big case, Kiobel v. Royal Dutch Petroleum.
Uh-huh.
The Supreme Court really narrowed down when you can use the Alien Tort Statute. They said there needs to be a strong connection between what happened and the U.S. itself. That makes things even harder for cases involving human rights abuses that happen completely outside the U.S.
So for future human rights lawyers, Doe v. Buratai is a bit of a wake-up call, huh? It shows just how tricky it can be to get justice against foreign officials in U.S. court. It's not just knowing human rights law. It's also mastering those rules of civil procedure, all those technicalities about immunity and jurisdiction. And it reinforces the fact that in the U.S. legal system, the courts, they don't act alone.
They do.
They're part of the system of checks and balances. And when a case has big implications for foreign policy, they're often going to tread carefully and let Congress and the president take the lead.
Absolutely. Doe v. Buratai shows us very clearly that even when we're talking about the most serious human rights violations, things that shock the conscience, those just Kojin's violations, it doesn't mean those foreign officials automatically lose their immunity, especially not if their own country was okay with what they did.
Right. It leaves you with a lot to think about. Given all these legal hurdles and knowing how important human rights are globally, where does that leave us? What should the role of domestic courts be in holding foreign officials accountable? What happens to international justice when these cases run into such massive legal roadblocks? Those are some heavy questions, but that's something to ponder on your own time. Join us next time for another deep dive into more legal complexity.
I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening.